My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris. Thank you very much for joining me for another episode of the show. Today, a great album. We're hurtling back into the 1990s. I'm going to be looking at Tori Amos's debut album, Little Earthquakes, with a very special guest who chose the album. She'll be coming up very shortly indeed, Loz Campbell. Great conversation all about the amazing songs that just litter Little Earthquakes all the way through from start to finish. It is a fantastic album. Really excited that we're doing it on the show. We've got some great albums coming up over the next few weeks on the podcast. In just a couple of weeks' time, at the beginning of June. So two great albums for June, I've got to say. Aaron Day from These Wicked Rivers is going to be joining me to chat all about Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's second album. The first with Neil Young, I guess. So we could call it debut or second album, depending how you want to put it. Deja Vu, great album, fantastic songs. Really excited to let you hear my chat with Aaron. And then we have Brian Kuznets from Fame on Fire, who has chosen an album that when I started this podcast 6 years ago, I felt it was a given that someone was going to pick this. And to be quite frank, I'm shocked no one's picked it sooner. A really important album of my teenage years. Brian has chosen Linkin Park's debut, Hybrid Theory, to talk about on the show. So, you know, great conversation for me, a blast back to my angsty teenage years where the music of Linkin Park was very much the soundtrack to my life at that time. So some great episodes coming up in June and more besides. Thank you to anyone who checked out our previous episode just a couple of weeks ago where we celebrated 50 years of Wishbone Ash's Argus album with Dan Morris from Firekind. And of course, thank you to Martin Turner as well for taking time out to chat about that process of recording Argus and what that's like to look back on 50 years later. You know, it's crazy. That episode and all of our previous episodes are still up online at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and wherever you listen to your podcasts. So, you know, have a look back. We're nearing 60 episodes now. We've covered some phenomenal albums in that time. Why don't you go and have a look? See if your favourite's up there. If it isn't, hopefully we'll be doing it soon, having some really cool chats with people about some great albums that we're going to be talking about over the coming months. So not much to say at the beginning of this episode of My Classic Album, so let's just get down to it. My special guest is the awesome Loz Campbell, and she has chosen Tori Amos' debut album, Little Earthquakes, to talk about on the show today. So before we get to my chat with Loz, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Little Earthquakes. Released on the 6th of January, 1992, Little Earthquakes is the debut solo album from American singer-songwriter Tori Amos. Rising from the ashes of synth-pop collective Why Can't Tori Read, Tori threw herself into a solo career, penning a collection of songs confessional and emotive in style. When label Atlantic Records rejected the first version of the album, Tori returned to the studio with boyfriend Eric Ross and reworked many of the tracks to the label's satisfaction without compromising her artistic integrity. The haunting Me and a Gun was released as a single in some territories, but with its pure a cappella sound and its lyrical depiction of rape, it gained little airplay. Silent All These Years and China both cracked the UK singles chart, being at number 51. However, it was Winter and Crucify that would break into the UK top 40, reaching number 25 and 15 respectively. Crucify also saw success on the US alternative airplay chart, reaching number 22. From the success of Winter and Crucify in the UK, Silent All These Years was re-released, and this time charted at number 26. While Little Earthquakes reached number 54 on the Billboard 200, the album's most successful territory was the UK, where it reached number 14. The album also equaled this success in Australia with a number 14 charting. Sales of Little Earthquakes over time have led it to certified gold in the UK, and 2x platinum in the US, with worldwide sales of over 3 million copies. Little Earthquakes is seen as a bold and powerful debut from Tori Amos, and the beginning of a career that is critically acclaimed to this day. Spin magazine ranked the album number 31 of the 90 best albums of the 1990s in 1999, while the German edition of Rolling Stone placed Little Earthquakes number 240 in their 500 greatest albums of all time in 2004. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Little Earthquakes, and I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about today on My Classic Album. This is Loz Campbell. How are you doing?
Hi everyone. I'm okay, thank you.
Lovely. So we were just touching on this a little bit there before I hit record. Why is it that you've chosen Little Earthquakes specifically to talk about on the show today?
Yeah, so we were just saying, weren't we, that, you know, obviously I'm a rock artist, and immediately you probably think I'd choose something like a, you know, Guns N' Roses or some sort of album like that. But I have got quite a varied music taste, and yeah, guitar wise, I've been inspired by, you know, Slash and Joe Bonamassa and people like that. However, there's a few people in my, you know, like playlist library in my head that I can pull out for, you know, songwriting, you know, inspiration. And Tori Amos is one. I mean, this album is just full of just so much to talk about with this album. Like, I had to sit down and listen to it, like I said to you last night, and just sort of like really analyze it, because I wanted to do it justice, basically, because it's a mega album.
I kind of get where you come from. I mean, we've done like 60-odd episodes of My Classic Album, and, you know, I think for me it was one of those albums that I felt that need to do it justice a little bit as well. So, hopefully we'll do that. What are your memories of hearing it for the first time?
So, obviously, like probably everybody else, I heard Cornflake Girl first and then Backtracked. And I reckon I was probably about 16, 17 at the time, maybe. So I was quite late, you know, in my musical listening sort of age, coming late to this sort of music, because I was, like I say, I was into my heavier stuff when I was younger. But I think as you grow up, you sort of tend to venture, don't you, into listening to, you know, different things. My immediate thought was, wow, you know, those, all I can describe it is like spine tingling. When she plays the piano, there's certain notes that really just tickle my spine, and not many people write songs like that. And I think, especially when I saw her live, it was just, she's just one of a kind. I mean, there's only certain people that can write that way and play that way. I mean, she's an absolutely amazing musician. And one thing that I always say about her, and, you know, about this album in particular, is every instrument has its own space. For example, when that, you know, when the strings come in, or when that little tiny electric guitar part comes in to complement it, it's not just something that's put in there as a background layer. It's got its own sort of space. That's all I can describe it as. Yeah. I don't know anybody else that can do that.
And I think it's the timing of us talking about this album is quite interesting for a couple of reasons we'll get into, I'm sure. But 2022 marks 30 years since Little Earthquakes came out. So in turn, that's 30 years of Tori Amos's kind of solo career. And you've touched on even kind of that spectacle of seeing her live and that impact she has. Why do you think she's managed to stay so relevant and influential and critically lauded kind of for all this time?
I think because the fans that she has, and this is my opinion of the people that I saw at the gig, the fans that she has are genuine music fans. They're not just your average guy that goes down to the pub and sinks a few pints and likes to belt out a bit of Stereophonics. They're genuine, like, they appreciate her talent, basically. And I think, you know, it's well deserved at the end of the day. And I think she's been able to continue it, one, because she hit it off straight out the gate, sort of thing. She hit it off well with this album, but also she's released so many other albums that for me just get better and better. Like the most recent one, I was just like, wow, she's done it again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think it's important to mention again, I was quite careful to say that it was been 30 years of her solo work, because I guess although it's a debut album, like, that doesn't feel like the beginning of the story, if you like. I mean, so she was very much like a child prodigy. She started composing music when she was 3. She was the youngest student at the Peabody Conservatory of Music when she was 5. Like, that's just crazy. And I just wanted to read a quote from her book from 2005, Tori Amos, Piece by Piece. And she talks about an experience of a condition she has known as chromesthesia. So she says, "The song appears as light filament once I've cracked it. As long as I've been doing this, which is more than 35 years, I've never seen the same light creature in my life. Obviously, similar chord progressions follow similar light patterns, but try to imagine the best kaleidoscope ever. After the initial excitement, you start to focus on each element's stunning original detail. For instance, the sound of the words with the sound of the chord progression combined with the rhythm manifests itself in a unique expression of the architecture of colour and light. I started visiting this world when I was 3. I visited a configuration that day that wasn't on this earth. It was euphoric." And I mean, I've heard, is it like Nile Rodgers, I think, has this condition as well. And it always really fascinates me. Do you think, because as I was reading it, I was just thinking about it, particularly with this album, and you were saying about the instruments having a place and, you know, all being very, all kind of just right, I guess, kind of on the record. Do you think that that's kind of her attempt to get across what she is seeing in terms of these kind of light patterns and this chromesthesia that she experiences in music?
Yes, totally. And it's so funny that you've said this because I know exactly what she means. Mm. And I had a similar conversation with my guitar tutor. I've, you know, finished studying guitar a few years ago and now I did classical. And my tutor at the time, she's a composer herself, and she was showing me, you know, some of the pieces, and I said to her, before I could read music and write music or really even explain how I wanted things to sound, so basically as a child, like you're saying, like 5 years old, I used to draw shapes in books as different drum patterns. So for example, a square would sound a certain way and a circle would sound a certain way. So I guess it's kind of similar, and I know exactly where Tori Amos is coming from on this, and I actually didn't know that. So thank you for that fact, because it makes total sense. And to other people, maybe they are, you know, creative, maybe they don't have a creative mind, or they might just listen to this, you know, she sees shapes, she sees colours, as Jesus, is she high? You know what I mean? Like, some people think, is she all right? But I totally, and there must be loads of musicians out there that do have the same sort of thing. Like, I remember my tutor also saying to me, she used to look up at the sky and hear the stars, which again, to other people, is like, what the heck? But I get it.
And I mean, obviously, this innate talent from such a young age, that led Tori Amos to be signed by Atlantic Records when she was just 17. So the world's first exposure to her was as the front woman of a synth pop group, Why Can't Tori Read, which included guitarist Steve Catton and future Guns N' Roses drummer Matt Sorum. So they released an album, ultimately disbanded. There were poor sales from the self-titled debut. Tori said of the album later on, "The only good thing about that album is my ankle-high boots." I don't know. I've not actually heard the album. Have you heard anything by Why Can't Tori Read? And if you have, is it different in any way from what we hear on Little Earthquakes and her solo career?
Do you know what? I'm ashamed, actually, to say that I haven't heard anything from that, but I will definitely go now check that out.
Yeah, I think, like I say, I know it's something that it's definitely on my list to do as well, but I think from what I can gather, it was very much more of, like, kind of stylistically and musically, like, of the time. You know what I mean? And I think that's what ties in. A lot of the stuff that comes up on this album comes from that, because it sounds like Little Earthquakes was her kind of reclaiming herself and discovering herself as an artist and as a person. So, yeah, definitely might be worth kind of both of us, I think, going back and having a listen to that.
Yeah, totally.
So because of that album failing, she had a 6-album deal to fulfill with Atlantic. So Tori took to Capitol Studios in LA with producer David Sigerson and recorded 12 songs through the early part of 1990. The relative failure of that Why Can't Tori Read project reintroduced Tori to her first love, which was the piano. So this is dig.com note of that time. They say it took a nudge from a friend to remind Tori of her roots. At the time, she didn't even have a piano in the house. But once she procured an old upright, there began a period of intense creativity. Amos often compares her deeply personal debut album with a diary. At a certain point, you go, well, what is my thing? Who am I? What am I all about? And it was an anomaly in the era of guitar-based grunge. And I guess that's what's quite interesting. We'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But how important you'd said about the way she plays certain notes on the piano being spine-tingling in both live and in the studio. How important do you think her performance on the piano alongside her voice is across this album.
I think as a pianist, she is unique, and also as a singer. So usually you get one or the other, don't you? But she is the full package, and I would love to shake her hand one day and just say thank you, because, I mean, it's just magic what she's done. And also, what I will say is, going back to like the chords and stuff, you know, you were saying it's in the time of grunge, but I know a lot of people that grew up in that time and were like heavy grunge fans that resonate with her music. I mean, how has she done that? How has she crossed every, you know, genre basically? And you can tell that as well. When I saw her live, there was people there, you're thinking, Jesus, are they coming to a Tori Amos concert? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I was watching a live performance of Winter, and obviously we'll talk loads about Winter when we get to it, but loads of the comments were saying things like about, how did they put it? It was something about kind of approaching the piano in an attitude that was almost metal. You know what I mean? And we wouldn't call Tori Amos metal, but like almost kind of the attitude in which she performs. And it's a really strange thing, because there's probably people sitting listening thinking, that makes no sense at all. But I totally understood where they were coming from kind of when I was reading those comments.
Yeah. And I think maybe because it's got that, you know, certain chords will give that feel. So if you go for a diminished seventh, let's say, it's going to have that gritty feel to it. You know, there's certain chords that you can use that remind you of certain types of music.
Yeah. And I think I've got a quote here from her, again, from Dig, that might give us a bit more insight. So she says, it was a real fight to get people to have a different image of what the piano was, and somebody had to fight that fight. While I was fighting it, I didn't realize that I happened to be that person, because when it's happening, you don't see it in a historical context. It became a mission of mine. I guess I became a vigilante, because I refused to see how the piano had been boxed into this definition of passive and non-confrontational. And I decided you could be confrontational and powerful, and the screaming had to be in the content, not necessarily in what your voice was doing. And I think that maybe ties in a bit with what we're saying, that, again, they're not just lovely little plinky plonky songs on the piano. There is some confrontation and some power and a statement being made with all of these songs.
Yeah, no note is lost. Do you know what I mean? Every single note means something to her, and that is just magic.
So, I mean, surprisingly, you know, she's got this collection of songs that she's proud of from these kind of sessions in 1990. She was shocked when the label actually rejected the songs that she submitted. So in an interview with Refinery29, she said, when I turned it into the label, they rejected it. And Doug Morris famously said he didn't get it. He and I had a negotiation that if I turned in two new songs, he wouldn't take the piano off and put guitars on the first incarnation of Little Earthquakes. And he didn't. I turned in four songs and the rest took a while. So, I mean, I guess that's what we're talking about. They're all, and it would have been difficult for them to see at the time. But, you know, again, it's that use of piano. Do you feel like it's an album that maybe, when we're talking about kind of Nirvana and Soundgarden and all of these kind of grungy bands coming through, do you think that maybe for a record company, an album like Little Earthquakes was potentially quite a risky album?
Yeah, totally, for the time. However, I was thinking last night when I was having a listen to it, some of the tracks actually remind me of Garbage, you know, the band who were around at that time anyway. So it's definitely got a hint of something, and I guess that's what they picked up on. But yeah, you know, good on them for taking a risk, and, you know, sometimes you got to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, there was this compromise that, you know, she did go back, return to the studio, recorded some of the songs as well, this time with her boyfriend, Eric Ross. So these are songs like Girl, Precious Things, Tear in Your Hand, Mother, and Little Earthquakes were some of those new songs. You know, it sounds like that initial vision for the album was primarily piano-based, but obviously the tracks we're talking about there are more kind of full band arrangements. Again, no note is lost, the instruments all have their place, but it is more of kind of a full band ensemble. You know, what do you think that things like the title track and Precious Things, do you feel that they add to the album in a way that makes it special?
You can definitely tell that they're the more, commercial tracks on the album, particularly Little Earthquakes, obviously it's a title track, but that was definitely pinpointed as the radio play one, wasn't it? You can tell how it's been written, and it's not as quirky as like Happy Phantom, which is one of my favourite ones. Mm. Precious Things is a little bit quirky. The lyrics in that really make me laugh. But I guess we'll get onto that later.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess for me, it's a true confessional album, isn't it? Well, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about the the personal nature of the lyrics and all of that kind of thing. And I'd argue we'd not seen an album like that since like Joni Mitchell's Blue, arguably. So it'd probably been a good 20 years since such a confessional album had come out. Slant magazine also draw comparisons to Madonna, saying that in a way, Little Earthquakes is like an estranged stepsister to Madonna's Like a Prayer. Both albums find their creators grappling with the oppressive religions with which they were raised and thorny father-daughter relationships. So coincidentally, we've covered Blue and Like a Prayer on My Classic Album in the past. We've done both. You know, do you feel that there's any connections or influence from either of those albums? Is there kind of a Joni Mitchell vibe at certain points of the album, or do you note that comparison to an album like a Prayer?
Tough one. I think this is, personally, I think it stands out on its own. I get where they're coming from with the Madonna thing. She's quite out there, isn't she? She reinvents herself quite a lot. And I think, to be honest, it feels to me like Tori Amos reinvented herself a lot of times throughout this one album. So I do get where they're coming from.
Do you think it's easy to do that sometimes, though, that it's like you've got these prominent women in music? So like Joni Mitchell recorded this like seminal album. Someone else releases a really personal album. So it's easy to go, oh, well, these two albums are the same. Or like Madonna releases an album in the 80s that touches on religion, as does Little Earthquakes. So it's easy to go, all right, okay, so these albums, we can put them in the same box. Because it sounds like you're saying, and I get where you're coming from, this album, in a lot of ways, and they're great albums, but this album does stand alone for what it is.
Yeah, I think it's a bit lazy, to be honest, to compare. I hate comparisons in any sense when it's music, because I think every musician is individual at the end of the day. I know we take inspiration from things, but you know, I don't like comparing. I never like to, you know, go see a band and go, oh, they sound like so and so. It's just, well, no, they don't. They sound like them.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, like, there might be certain points in this album where you hear something that's got like a tinge of someone else, but
yeah,
you know.
Well, I've just like said it, haven't I, with the garbage?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So,
you know, everyone does it, even though I don't like doing it. We all do it.
but I think at the same time, it's an acknowledgement of what a personal album this is. And again, like you say, that it is, you know, for me, it's unlike any album I've ever listened to before. It's an album that, as you say, it stands alone. And, you know, I think it is interesting that I guess I'm curious if there have been albums since that have been compared to Little Earthquakes. You know what I mean? Some of the artists that maybe she's inspired over the years.
Yeah, well, I can think of one, but again, I hate to compare, but Agnes Obel. I did actually write down on Little Earthquakes Agnes Obel, because you know, it's got some layered vocals in there, which I just heard something. I thought, oh, I wonder if she's listened to that and you know, taken some inspiration from it.
I mean, like I say, we've talked so much already about it being a really personal album, you know, her putting so much into it. It tackles a lot of subjects that at the time of release people found quite uncomfortable, some of them arguably that people find now. So NME lauds the album, so they say, with songs about her mother, father, sex, religion, abuse and mental illness, it stood and shook as a monument to a life lived. He was a woman taking stock of all her experiences to date and expressing them in the most magical yet visceral way possible. So I mean, a lot of these subjects, particularly things like mental illness and sexual abuse, like these are things that were just flat out not discussed within popular music at all. And then here comes Tori Amos, you know, not afraid to kind of tackle that stuff. Do you think that takes like a certain kind of bravery to, I mean, particularly if we think about Me and a Gun towards the end of the album, you know, to share these really, really difficult experiences in such a raw and personal way?
I think she was very brave to document that in a song. Yeah. 100%. I mean, when I first listened to it, I was only young, so I didn't really, you know, register what it was about, but I knew it was something bad. A few years later, I thought, hang on a sec, I think I know what's going on here. And I did Google it and I said, you know, what is Me and a Gun about? And there you go. But I think she's done it in a clever way. The whole album and all the topics that she's covered, I think she's done it in a very clever way. And that's something I try and do when I write. I don't like to go straight down, you know, and hit you on the nose with it. I like to, she's made a joke of quite a lot of things in this song. And the lyrics, I picked out loads of lyrics last night that make me laugh. And that's why I love Tori Amos, because I just think, yeah, it's, What a clever way to go about it, basically.
And you're right. And I guess I'm looking forward to hearing that too, because again, there's certain ones that jump out at me that, you know, they're either really witty or she's talking about something quite, quite difficult or quite dark, but she's able to find the humor in it, or find some humor in it. And I think, again, that just says something to her and her kind of process and all of that stuff.
Totally.
So, I mean, there was some resistance, particularly in the US, as you can imagine, for certain songs off the album to be played on the radio.
Yeah.
And there was a press release from Atlantic Records, and I've got it here. So it famously said, "These stations won't play the Tori Amos record, Little Earthquakes, because they find the lyrics too offensive." And then a list of about four or five different stations that wouldn't play it. "Well, we think this is fucking bullshit." And then in brackets, censorship sucks, which is just like fantastic, I think. But I mean, do you think, again, the lyrics, you know, we've talked about them being funny, we've talked about them being raw, but, you know, you were saying, even as a young girl, we'll talk about me and a gun later on, but even as a young girl, you were like, "I don't know what this is about, but I know it's bad. You know, I know that this is something really foreboding." Do you think that, I think that the fact of it is, it's not just, you know, we think about artists today who might, or even in the 90s and the 80s, who are releasing stuff just for the sake of being controversial. I think this is just more about this kind of uncomfortable truth. Do you think that, you know, maybe some of the stuff she was talking about just didn't sit well with that concept of everyday FM radio?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, people like to brush things under the carpet, don't they? And especially probably back then, you know, rather than today. When you've got people, you know, in the popular charts, and probably at that time as well, talking about like "Slap My You Know What" and you know, there's a lot of offensive lyrics in popular music, like, that little kids listen to, and sometimes I think, what the heck is going on? Like, kids are talking about like weird things, you know. But this is something that, you know, we're now told to speak out about, and I think it's not like she's putting it across in a way that is offensive. I think she's putting it across because, I mean, I found it chilling because there is no music behind that. It's a cappella, isn't it? So that's why I was like, what's going on? And you can hear the pain in her voice as well. Yeah, probably it's not right for radio play just because it doesn't really fit with the other tracks that they probably play after it. But definitely other tracks on this album, even though some of the lyrics might be a bit controversial, shall we say, I think it's definitely... why not? This is life, it's real. We all go through these things. So,
and I mean, in spite of that, Little Earthquakes, it immediately became this huge critical success. You know, it did pretty well here in the UK as well. Kickstarted Tori Amos's career. Rolling Stone said at the time, "Newcomer Tori Amos's songs are smart, melodic, and dramatic. The deeper you listen, the hotter they get. Amos shares common ground with art folk songstresses like Kate Bush and Jane Siberry. But while they often deal in abstruse, poetic terms, Amos has a tendency to cut to the quick, to face facts, to call a rape a rape." And I mean, do you think that's an important factor in her success? That, like you say, she's not trying to be controversial. She's not trying to, you know, litter her songs with swear words or to get headlines or anything like that. She's just being real, but she's doing it in a very beautiful and melodic way. Do you think that's the most important fact? Well, an important factor in her success to this point.
Yeah, I think people love, you know, people who are real, especially I do. There's nothing worse than dealing with somebody who's fake. But, you know, you can totally tell she's an honest person. She's the type of person you could probably sit down with and have a cup of tea. You know, she's that sort of, you can just tell that she's so down to earth, and she literally does music because she loves it. You can tell, you know. So I think some people do write, like you say, to get headlines or to say, what, does this work? Will this get me further? Whereas she is just spilling out her heart, basically. And I love that.
And I think, to be honest, we've talked about a few of the tracks already. I think it just seems the perfect time to go track by track, and we'll dive into some of these. So let's start with Crucify. So this is actually one of my favorites, and the opening track on the album. Music News say, in the opening track, Crucify, fans hear the singer breaking free from many of the constraints and chains that religion has placed upon her. It's a defiant song, certainly empowering for those imprisoned by their own beliefs and struggling to break the hold they have. I mean, certainly a really, if we think about it from two perspectives, it's a daring song to open your album with, but I think it's also a daring song to essentially kind of open your career with as well. I mean, how does it open the album for you? Like, how does it fare as an opener?
I think it's a very good opener. I think it's not too controversial, I wouldn't say. It didn't strike me as you know, I found it quite a easy going song, shall we say. It's not too like, whoa, you know. What I will say about this track is it's the bass drum sound is like what everyone dreams of. And you'll know, you'll be listening for it now.
I will be. I definitely will. I mean, Medium, they praise the song. They say, singing about mistrust, anger, rebellion, sex and religion, it must pull zero punches on topics normally too taboo to address, especially when coming from a woman in a male-dominated business. And I think that's a good point, because again, in the context of what, as we said, that context of what was going on in the early 90s, we talked about grunge, hair metal's dying out. So when you were saying about those kind of lyrics earlier on that, you know, that people were singing, a lot of them probably came from hair metal, to be honest, as well as pop.
Yeah.
In the context of all of that, you've got Tori Amos just kind of there. I can't think of anyone else who, you know, maybe Madonna, a couple of those things, but in terms of kind of all of these topics as a whole, I can't think of anyone else who was talking about these things in the way that Tori Amos was.
Yeah, it's not just like a sentence in the song, is it? It's the whole song is, you know, wrapped around these subjects.
Yeah. And I think as well, it's obviously, we'll talk a bit about, there was some controversy with it in the US. And I think, you know, obviously, I think the way that the US, kind of the role of religion in America is very different to what it is over here. But I wonder as well if the word crucify, I think, has obviously very religious connotations in many situations. So to, again, to have a song to open your album with the name Crucify, to have these kind of religious themes, I guess, while, you know, me and you might have listened to it and thought, yeah, this isn't the most controversial song I've ever heard, in America, it might have provoked a very different response.
Yeah, totally. I think that's, I've never even thought about it that way, to be honest, because I'm not religious, but I can understand where you're coming from on that one.
Yeah. I mean, it, as we say, it was in America primarily, and she talked about it in 1992 to Hollywood Reports. She said, I've been in the alternative stations because they won't play my lyrics. The whole Bible Belt banned me for Crucify because they thought I was being sacrilegious. They felt it was detrimental material for their children and that it was blasphemous. So Crucify was banned. Silent all these years with the Antichrist. I'd be better using four-letter words. I guess, as it, we're talking about that, what I've got written here is what a big risk that'll have been early in her career. But I just go back to kind of what you were saying and what was in the charts at the time and what was going on in popular music at the time. Like, yet yeah, this is what's riling people up and this is what's stirring people up, as opposed to, you know, the gangster rap that was coming through or kind of certain Nirvana tracks or whatever you want to compare it to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they didn't like those either. It's funny how it can become a bit more diluted when it's swamped with guitars.
Mm. What is it about that bass drum? So I know you were saying like that's like a sound that you like you dream of. What is it about that that makes it kind of perfection?
I think every musician that's been in the studio will know what I mean, because it's the one thing that you want is a good like bass and snare sound, because it's what makes it feel live. And I love that. Like, that's the main reason why I fell in love with music and live gigs, really, is because I love that thumping bass drum through my chest at a gig.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this engineer did definitely capture that on this track.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of many songs. I mean, I'd be interested to know, actually, I know you said you'd seen her live. Off the top of your head, kind of a random number, how many songs from Little Earthquakes do you think made the set list?
Oh, well, she was actually touring. I'm trying to think which album it was now. It was a few years back and I can't remember the name of it. She did play Precious Things, I remember, Silent All These Years, and Winter.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if she played anything else, but those definitely stand out for me.
Yeah. I mean, there's loads of songs on this album, obviously with it being a classic album, there's loads of them that have just kind of been really embraced over the last 30 years. This one obviously did pretty well over here, charting at number 15. Why do you think that Crucify has resonated in the way it has since its release?
I think, to be honest with you, it's one of the most commercial songs on the track. I know, not obviously because of the reasons we've said with the religion and stuff, but I think it's very catchy. You can sing along to the chorus. And probably people resonate with it because it is truthful and they can relate to it, even though they don't want to, maybe.
Yeah. So we'll move on to Girl. So this seems to be a song about her, Tori's internal battle as to what kind of artist she wants to be. And I feel that's a theme kind of throughout the album, quite significant after the breakup of the band that she was in. And she told Rolling Stone, she said, it's not an aggressive fight. It's an internal fight. that when you need other people's approval, when you walk in a room, you're everybody's or anybody's girl. When you don't need that anymore, it's because you have an understanding and an agreement with yourself on who you want to be. And when I say who you want to be, that's going to evolve. But at least you've got to get your palette, your paint, your canvas, and say, I'm not choosing to tell this story, which is doing anything to have success. I don't want that kind of success, which is bang on something you'd said earlier, that, you know, this is an album for her. It's not really an album to get to the top of the Billboard charts or for her to become a millionaire or anything like that. Is that an internal fight that you think that, like, is that something you grappled with in your career about kind of recording the music that you want to, and it being, yeah, about you telling your own story rather than it being about success?
Yeah, I think with the latest track that we've just released, Bad Girl, we went heavier, and that's always something I've wanted to do. But my producer said to me, he said, you might get some of your previous fans, you know, that don't like this new track. Fingers crossed, so far I've not heard anything from anyone, but, you know, I'm sure there's somebody that could say something. But I think as a musician, it's really important to do it for yourself, because if you aren't, you can't please everybody all the time. You've got to be happy with what you put out, and if people like it, that's a bonus for me, you know. And I think this is why we do music in the first place, because we enjoy it. If other people like it, that, you know, like I say, it is a bonus. But yeah, you can. I definitely know where she's coming from on this one, and I've got some lyrics written down as well. Everybody else's girl, maybe one day she'll be her own. I love that. But also, because I see that in a bit of a different light as well. Like, for example, with the Bad Girl track that I've just released, I saw it as everybody else's girl, meaning everybody, you know, might want her because she's in the spotlight. Maybe one day she'll be her own, so maybe one day she'll just be happy with herself. Mm. And that's how I always interpreted that. But yeah, it's funny how you know, say it means something different.
And I think that can change as well. I've forgotten what song it's about. It might even be Winter, but I've got a quote later on about Tori saying about how the meanings of the songs change for her. And, you know, I think that's why I always like it when, I don't think there's ever anything wrong with it, you know, with an artist saying, well, look, this is what this song is about. But allowing that mystery and allowing it to resonate with the person who's listening in their own way. And I think that's something she's always been really good at.
Yeah. It's like I say, because she's put it across in the clever way that she has done, it does leave it open, and it can be, it's not straight hit you on the nose, and I like that.
Yeah. I mean, Girl was one of the tracks, as we'd said, you know, if the label initially rejected it, Girl was one of the tracks that was added to Little Earthquakes. In the Little Earthquakes songbook, Tori admits that the song had initially been disregarded, that she decided it was no good, until her boyfriend Eric Ross heard it, saying, I threw it down on tape and forgot about it. Months later, I was cleaning the house and was throwing tapes away. Eric intercepted this one out of a pile. I was chopping onions in the kitchen. He brought it in and said, listen, I did. And I think, I guess that's an interesting thing, that sometimes we can sometimes get a bit, I mean, do you find this, that sometimes you may be too close to the stuff that you're doing, and you maybe need that other ear of someone else, like someone else in your band or someone else in your circle, to be like, you know what, actually, what you've done here is like amazing. Like, give this another listen, give this another chance.
Yeah, totally. I've got loads of demos, you know, saved away, and half of songs and such. And, you know, I think, you know, most of the time, the most successful songs are the ones that just fall out, and also the ones that you're like, yep, this is the one. Mm-hmm. Rather than the slow burners. And this, to me, sounds like a slow burner for her. It's not necessarily that it's a bad track, because I don't think there's any skippers on this album, personally. Mm. But I know why she might have thought it was, you know, not meant to be on the album. It's a bit, because it takes a bit of a turn in the middle eight. I have said it reminds me of Garbage, that, you know, I talked about earlier, the band, yeah. Garbage. It's because it does take that bit of it. It's kind of like a cut and paste song, I think. Mm. So maybe she added that in later, I don't know.
A really daring album, and you'll hear that so much more as we continue with my conversation with Loz Campbell, and we go track by track through Little Earthquakes. It's certainly an album that's inspired Loz, that's inspired loads of musicians out there, surely, loads of songwriters. And, you know, it's a phenomenal album. Really pleased that we're finally covering it on the show. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Little Earthquakes, on my classic album, on Loz, on anything, really. Absolutely, get in touch with us in the usual places. Get yourself to Facebook. Have a look for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page. Follow My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, and make sure you follow us, and get yourself on Twitter at MCA_podcast. All that information, all of our previous episodes, including this one, are all up on www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and over on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. But now, some music. Sit back and enjoy the new single, the latest single from Loz Campbell. This is Bad Girl. So we'll move on to Silent All These Years. I mean, Tori shared the genesis of this one with Rolling Stone. She said, I was with my niece Cody, who was a little girl at the time. She's very much a part of Silent All These Years because she loved fairy tales and stories. And we would share the Little Mermaid story, Hans Christian Andersen, and the idea that she'd lost her voice. And watching Cody respond to this young woman giving up her essence and power all for something else. And in that moment, I realized that when she had no voice, that just completely took me to the place where I needed to go to reclaim it. And it's funny. I mean, I've listened to that song like many times over the years. And then after reading that about kind of the links to The Little Mermaid and kind of losing her voice and stuff, it's so obviously there front and center, but I never really spotted it.
Yeah, I love that actually. And thanks for these facts. I'm really enjoying them. I've got lyrics written down for this as well. So like, what if I'm a mermaid in these jeans of his with her name still on it? What a great line that is. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it because it makes you think, hang on a sec, what does she mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think obviously to move the lyrics to one side for a minute, musically, she'd written the music for Silent Roll These Years with Al Stewart in mind after he asked her to write for him. Again, it was Eric that intervened, insisting she kept it, saying, you're out of your mind. That's your life story. That's how he put it. Now, again, he was saying that before she'd even written lyrics to it, which I find really interesting.
Yeah.
Is there anything, and this is probably quite a difficult question to ask, bear in mind that we're not Tori Amos, but is there anything musically in that song that stands out that would support what he's saying there? Is there anything that makes you particularly see where he's coming from, perhaps?
I mean, if he's very hard, and I don't understand how he could hear that without lyrics, that it was a life story, unless he was meaning there was some sort of build in the track and there's some sort of growth. But I don't actually know how he heard that. It's quite impressive, actually. Yeah.
I mean, like I say, I mean, I guess if they were in a relationship, he's much more privy to be able to kind of say that kind of stuff. It's just, it was a really interesting thing to say. And when I initially read it, I thought, oh, you know, is he talking about the lyrics? But then obviously diving deeper in, it was the music that he'd said that about, which I thought was really, really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And I will listen intently, actually, to it after this.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to share Tori's insight in an interview, and there's a particular part of this that I've underlined because I love it as a quote. So I'll come back to it at the end. But this is what Tori said in an interview with Keyboard Magazine, where she was discussing this contrast between kind of the darker side of the lyrics in this song and the light melody. And she said, "Silent All These Years has a certain storyline going on musically that's really the antithesis of what's going on verbally. It's counterpoint pure and simple, but instead of French horns and cellos or something, it's words and music. And I find it very exciting when an acoustic instrument has its knife out." And that's the bit that I really like. Obviously, this idea, going back to what she was saying before, that you don't have to use the piano to be this kind of mellow, romantic instrument. You know, you can get its knife out, essentially, you know what I mean? And kind of use it in a more aggressive way, kind of different sides to that. Do you think that's a strength of the album and her music as a whole, the way that she uses the piano beyond just, oh, that sounds lovely?
Yeah, she's totally broken every barrier. I've tried over the years. I'm not a pianist, obviously, I'm a guitarist, but I have tried to play because I love her tracks.
Yeah.
And it's just, you just start playing and you just think, oh, forget it, and throw the piano out the window. Because I think it's just she's one of those people that, you know, it's very hard to copy that, very hard. It's not like this is a C major chord with something over the top of it. Mm. It's all over the place.
Yeah. And I know you're saying as we're going on, you kind of picked out certain lyrics that you liked throughout the album. I know that Slant Magazine highlights Silent All These Years as an example of humour and whimsy, as they put it, in her lyrics.
Yeah.
They say it's hard not to see direct links back to Little Earthquakes in the unsparing, often self-deprecating songwriting of Taylor Swift and the haunting conceptual Baroque pop of Bat for Lashes. Now, I know you said you hate comparisons, but can you hear her influence in contemporary artists like Taylor Swift? Do you think that, you know, what she's done here on Little Earthquakes has carried on to, you know, some of these kind of big stars that are around today?
Taylor Swift, not so much. I am shocked by that one, but maybe her earlier stuff. Bat for Lashes, love them. And yes, I can hear some elements, yeah.
So we'll move on to Precious Things, which Music News single out as a highlight of the album, saying one of the undeniable diamonds of the album is the epic track Precious Things. Amos's impassioned vocals bring this 5-minute gem to life, with the song's majestic riff dragging the listener in and refusing to let go. It's a remarkably dark and edgy track. Now, I know, obviously, we all have our favourites on an album, and I know that you've kind of named a couple of yours so far. Would you say that Precious Things, is it a favourite? Is it a diamond of the album, as they would say?
Yeah, I think it is probably in my top three on here. The piano intro for me is magical. I love it. I've just put, again, like all the way through, I've just put spine tingling chords. It just does it to me on every track. But yeah, I've got some funny lyrics for this one. I really like this one.
Yeah. So what are the lyrics for this one? Because I've got a feeling they're probably the same ones that stand out for me as well. So I was curious what they are.
Okay, so it's you're a really ugly girl, but I like the way you play. I really love that because I know obviously where she's coming from. She's probably like sat in the corner of a pub and some idiots come up to her, and we've all been there. Yeah, that makes me laugh. And the other one is not too PC, so I don't know if I can say it.
No, go for it.
So you can make me come, it doesn't mean you're Jesus. And I just put laughing faces all the way after that because I just love that line. It's brilliant.
And that's one that's probably kind of snuck in there a little bit there as well. You know what I mean? It might not be one that everybody necessarily picks up on.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I would, because I just think stuff like that's hilarious.
And yeah.
Especially coming from a woman, like you say, in that time, she's kind of just you know, using that musical genius pedestal that she's got to sort of just make a bit of a joke about, you know, how some guys can be. And we've all been there. And, you know, I've had people, you know, say to me, "Oh, mission complete." And it's like, what? You know, don't make you Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, she told the story of Precious Things during a VH1 Storytellers performance. And she said, "Precious Things is a song that came to me when I was living behind a church. I was about 24 years old. I had a roommate that listened to really raucous music, and it started to take me into flashbacks of my grandmother. She put me in a corner and she would read me something, I think from Leviticus, I can't remember, but she was convinced that I was going to give my soul to God and my body to a man that I would marry. But at 5 years old, I knew that we were enemies. So in my mind, I was always trying to find ways to get away from this creature." So she's talked quite a lot about this really not pleasant relationship with her grandmother. And I think, you know, obviously there's like the wails that come through in this song as well. You know what I mean? I think you can almost kind of hear that darkness and anguish in the song, like I said, particularly in those moments where she just kind of sort of wails.
Yeah, it's interesting that, and I think that might be a generation thing, because obviously at the time, you know, the older generation, was it like post-war or something, it was very different to how it is now. You know, like me and my grandparents are very close. But yeah, I mean, especially something that stands out that is a bit dark for me is the drum pattern. It kind of, it's not straight, for example. It's like really jarred. I like it. There's a very interesting drum pattern, but you can definitely adds to that sort of feel that you're talking about.
And like I say, obviously, you know, we talk about sometimes comparisons being a bit lazy sometimes. I know that Slant Magazine, they say that while Kate Bush has been an easy, frequent point of reference for rock critics since the start of Amos's career, that kind of easy comparison, Kate Bush, Tori Amos, that she's more often cited rock gods like Led Zeppelin as inspiration. They say you can hear the band's influence on Precious Things, not just in the wails, which evoke Robert Plant in Immigrant Song, but in a frenzied piano playing. I mean, do you think, and again, this is talking more about influence than comparison, you know, she's cited Led Zeppelin as an inspiration at some point. Can you hear any influence of bands like Led Zeppelin in this song?
Yeah, definitely. Like you've said, with the wailing. I think I just need to touch on that Kate Bush thing because it's making me laugh every time. I think they've picked her out because they're both slightly different, aren't they, from the rest of the crowd? But they're totally different from each other. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's the lazy comparison, isn't it?
Yeah, it's rubbish, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the Led Zeppelin, that's interesting. I'm just trying to imagine the album in my head a minute. Yeah, I guess they did quite a lot of new things for their time, didn't they? And then she's sort of picked up from where they left off, possibly.
Yeah.
But with piano rather than guitar.
And I think that's it, because again, I think it's sometimes so easy to say, I don't know, with Guns N' Roses, there's a very heavy Aerosmith influence in Guns N' Roses, for example. And that's because they're both hard rock bands. But that's not to say that someone like you say, that Tori Amos can't take the spirit and the essence of what Led Zeppelin were doing and transfer it to the piano. And yet it kind of be different, but pay tribute to that.
I think that's a better way of showing an influence. Because it's taking what you like, but totally changing it, if that makes sense.
So we'll move on to, I'm sure this is many people's favourite song on the album, and it's definitely mine, which is Winter. So, yeah. So Dig called Winter an exquisitely tender song about paternal love, inspired by Amos's father and grandfather. So as I'd said there, this is, you know, this is probably, if people have got like a casual knowledge of Tori Amos, it's probably Cornflake Girl, like you were saying, and Winter. They're probably the two. Why do you think this has become such a popular song for her?
I'm not too sure. It's not actually one of my favourite ones. But I guess because people can, you know, maybe understand what's going on in this track more than the others, possibly. I've got down here that it sounds like Snowflakes, this song. And I don't, it's probably a rubbish thing, but
I think it just sounds
like Snowflakes, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I get that.
If Snowflakes could make music, that's what it would be like.
I mean, my first exposure to this song, and this might seem quite random for some people, my first exposure of this song came from reading the memoirs of wrestling legend Mick Foley. So he quite beautifully recalls his first time here in Little Earthquakes and Winter specifically in his book, Countdown to Lockdown. So this has made me think when you were saying you were at Tori Amos concert and you're thinking, these people here see Tori Amos. For anyone who doesn't follow wrestling, has no idea at all, Mick Foley is like, he was 6'2", long black hair, missing teeth, had an ear ripped off in Germany in 1994. Yet Tori Amos is probably like his favorite musical artist. Do you know what
Brilliant.
I mean?
So I love it.
It just shows you kind of the scope. So this is what Mick said about this song. So he said, the first few songs off the album, Little Earthquakes, were unlike anything I'd ever heard. And then there was Winter. Snow Can Wait, I Forgot My Mittens, she sang. Wipe My Nose, Get My New Boots On. If there is such a thing as love at first listen, I fell helplessly, hopelessly in love from that very first lyric. And I mean, the rest of that chapter is basically him talking about how much he loves Tori Amos and how he eventually got to meet her and what an experience that was. Does it feel like, I know you were saying it's maybe not one of your favorite tracks on the album, but it does seem to jump out for a lot of people, including Mick. Does it feel like an important part of the album for that reason?
Yeah, I mean, it's slap bang in the middle of the album, isn't it? So it's one of those that you've got to put in there to keep the interest. And yeah, I mean, everyone's individual. They like it for their own reasons. And that's it.
Yeah. I mean, Treble Zine call it the one true love song on the album, saying it embraces the advice and memories of her father. It's the only time in Little Earthquakes where she seems to have an ally and protector, even if he's present only to remind her to stand up for herself and pursue her dreams. And I think, again, to go back to Mick Foley, he said many times that this is the song that he listens to kind of build himself up. So if his confidence is low, if he's feeling like that self-esteem's in the floor, that he needs that pick-me-up, Winter is the song that he goes to. And again, anyone who's not kind of watching him as much as, like, he had some brutal bloody wrestling matches in his time, and he said he'd be sitting in the locker room waiting, listening to Winter by Tori Amos before he went out there. So that gives you a bit of an idea. You know, I know you said it's not one of your favorites. I know you talked a little bit about the idea of it kind of being, if snowflakes could create music, like, this is what it would sound like. You know, is it, do you get that kind of positive lift from it that maybe other people do? Or is it, do you find that kind of elsewhere on the album?
Yeah, definitely. And like I said before, it's not necessarily a skipper. I wouldn't skip any of these tracks, but maybe that's why it doesn't sit well with me totally, because it is different from the rest of the tracks. It kind of does break out into a more positive vibe. Yeah, now you've mentioned it, when I'm looking at the other songs and the lyrics and such, it is very like a defensive approach, isn't it, rather than this one. But yeah, I'll probably listen to it differently now that we've talked about it like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've read quite a bit. We were talking earlier about kind of how the meaning of songs can like change, but also this is the one that the meaning for her has changed over the years. So obviously writing it about her relationship with her father, it then being about other important people in her life as she performed over the years, and now as she's a parent to her daughter Natasha, again changes it again, because she's looking at it from that other side. And I think it's really beautiful to think that in some ways, like, the song has grown with her in the way that it's kind of, so many people have taken it to their hearts, but the song's grown with her, and like, it's changed for her as well.
Yeah, there's not many songs that could do that, really. So again, credit to her for her writing, because she's left it open to change, and she probably didn't realise that when she wrote it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to, before we kind of move on to one of your favourite tracks, Dig actually ranked Winter as the best song of Tori's career, saying, from Little Earthquakes, an album full of fire and fury, the delicate appeal of Winter has endured like a snowdrop and tops our list of the best Tori Amos songs. And I know, obviously, like you'd said, you know, maybe that's why it ironically doesn't stand out for you as much, because it does stand out, if that
makes sense. Yeah. I tend to go the other way. People are walking one way, I'll go the other way.
if for you, and again, it's all subjective, isn't it? But, you know, if Winter isn't your favourite Tori Amos song, and maybe not necessarily from this album, what would you say is kind of your kind of greatest moment from her?
One track that's always stood out for me is Leather. I absolutely love that track.
Cool. Well, we'll get into that pretty soon, so that's awesome. But we'll go to Happy Phantom, which I know you'd said was one of your favourites. Music news say, for Happy Phantom, Amos worked with composer and musician John Philip Chenail, her longtime collaborator, A Tale of Death. Happy Phantom is a quirky, up-tempo track that unveils Amos's vibrant humour and wit. Do you think, obviously, we've had this, you know, we've had the kind of this beautiful track in Winter that we've talked about quite a bit. Is this a good choice to have kind of immediately after kind of something a little more quirky and upbeat?
Yeah, I think this album is very well laid out and definitely it needed that, didn't it, after Winter. This is actually the one of the songs that I tried to learn on piano. Definitely one of my favourites. It was all right to learn, actually, this one. I didn't throw the piano out the window.
Why do you think that is? Is it just, for lack of a better word of putting it, is it like an easier song to learn, or was it just that?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it does follow a little bit of a pattern, as a little bit more repetition than the others. I think when you really like something and you really want to play it, you try harder, don't you, to learn it. But yeah, maybe that's it. There's some cool lyrics in this one as well. I like it.
any particular ones that stand out?
Yeah, I've got it written down here. And I'll run naked through the street without my mask on. I just think that's hilarious.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because there's something just come to mind that I'll probably talk about in a little bit, but Tori told Rolling Stone, she said, to talk about death was really important on Little Earthquakes because there was a part of me that had to die. The image that I'd created for whatever reason had to die. And so she's referencing those Why Can't Tori Read days. So it sounds like kind of under this, like, obviously there's been a song about death and being, like the word I put is like jaunty, kind of that kind of little piano riff's almost quite jaunty. It sounds like that what's happening is quite a cathartic experience as well, that she's kind of putting this part of her aside and being like, this is who I am, and this album is a better representation of who I am.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It's like, it's definitely making a mock of her past self, isn't it? That's why it's funny, because it's like, she can laugh at herself, basically, which is quite good.
Yeah. I mean, what I was thinking about, this just come to mind, because obviously when we've done so many episodes of this, like, I end up finding really weird links to, like, albums that you just wouldn't expect. So what I was thinking about is that, you know, A couple of months ago, we did My Chemical Romance's The Black Parade, yeah? And obviously an album very much about death. And I think the people who'd chosen the album were actually The Warning, who are from Mexico. So I was kind of coming at it, you know, in the UK, death's something, it's a bit taboo. We don't really like to talk about it. You know, it's kind of the elephant in the room. Maybe a little bit in America as well. Whereas where they were coming from with it is, oh, well, in Mexico, it's something that we really celebrate. Like, we have the Day of the Dead and, you know, like, so they're coming from a very different angle. So I guess it's interesting that, you know, in some cultures, people would listen to this song about death and it being quite upbeat and think that that was somehow a contrast and somehow odd. But then maybe in other parts of the world or kind of other cultures that actually it would be quite appropriate.
Yeah, I'd never even thought about that, but I just thought there is an artist over there that I really do like, and he draws, like, you know, Mexican themed art, and they're all skeletons, and I guess that's basically, you know, what they're talking about there. But yeah, Happy Phantom, it's a funny one, isn't it? I just think it's a cool track. It's just totally, like, it just makes me smile, and especially with you saying it's about death as well, it seems a bit weird to be like smiling at a track about death.
Do you think it's a bit of an underrated one compared to some of these other tracks that we've been talking about so far? Do you think it's maybe, like, in the wider scope of things, do you think it's quite an underrated track on the album?
Yeah, and I don't know why, really. It's not, obviously we know it's not as commercial, but I think it's a cool track personally.
We'll move on to China. So this was originally called Distance, and it's kind of the oldest song on the album, for lack of a better way of putting it. So Tori actually wrote this, like, way back in, I think, 87. So it's kind of the first song written for Little Earthquakes, back when it was called Distance. I've heard it called the most traditional ballad on the album. Is that something that you'd agree with? Does it feel more traditional than maybe the songs around it?
Yeah, and I would say ballad, because it's always made me feel sad, this track. Like, I put this on, like, after many a breakups, and, like, sat in the bath with a glass of wine and, like, listened to China. It's gotta be done.
I mean, it's funny you saying that. I mean, Tori told Rolling Stone, she said that China probably came after a big bout of listening to Barbara Streisand.
Okay.
She says, if anyone can break your heart, she could. And, you know, again, by Tori's standards, it's quite a traditional ballad. Barbara Streisand, arguably, like, the queen of the ballad in some ways. So, you know, perhaps there is a bit of a Streisand vibe there, and that's maybe why it kind of resonates in the way that it does for people.
Yeah, the top breakup song.
Yeah. I mean, it was actually released as a single here in the UK, so it charted at number 51 on the singles charts. I mean, with all this talk about it being a good ballad and stuff, and again, obviously, this is something that must come, it certainly goes through the minds of record companies when they're releasing these albums, and I guess it must do for you guys as well as you're recording. Does China feel like it was a good choice for a single? Or do you think that there, because I guess it's more radio friendly, but do you think that there are maybe other songs on the album that better encapsulate what the album's about that would have been maybe a better single?
For Tori Amos fans, yeah, probably other tracks on the album would have been a better single. But, you know, people like to hear other people's pain, don't they? And I have always said in this track, you can hear the pain. And people, you know, we're all nosy, aren't we? We all love like a heartbreak track and, oh, I wonder what happened to them. And that's what this track is at the end of the day. You know, heartbreak makes great songs. So
we'll move on to, so am I right in thinking, did you say that this is probably your favourite Tori Amos song?
Yeah, and when you listen to, like, so for example, we're just talking about chilling in the bath with a glass of wine after a breakup. This is like the point where you just like kick out the doors and say, actually, yeah, this is stuff you, sort of thing. I think that's the alternative side of the breakup album is the track Leather.
That's really interesting you should say that, because I've got down here what inspired the song. And if you take that attitude of like, well, no, screw you, that fits really well.
Yeah.
So, you know, song facts say that she was living in a rundown apartment in Hollywood when a so-called friend stopped by to borrow some sugar. And when the singer played her an offering from Little Earthquakes, the woman told her that it wasn't catchy and she should consider changing her writing style. After she left, Tori wrote Leather in 8 minutes. So rather than taking that on board and being like, oh, well, maybe I should do things a little bit differently. It sounds like it's like a, like, imagine being that friend. That's like the ultimate fuck you, isn't it?
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, what is it? So I know you were saying, you know, obviously there's that side of it that it's kind of almost the other side of China, and that it's kind of to kind of bring you out of that sadness. But what else is it about the song that you love? Is there anything particular that stands out for you on Leather?
Yeah, I just heard the chorus going through my head then, actually, and it's that little electric guitar part. It's just so well placed, and it complements, you know, everything. It complements everything in the track.
And I know I've not got it here in front of us, but I'd read an interview with her where she was saying that Tori, she was quite surprised to hear that a lot of her songs are used for like sort of like pole dancing lessons and stripping okay, and that kind of thing. Yeah. And one of the songs was Leather. And it's funny because, again, it's not until we've been talking about it that I was thinking, like, you know, is that a song that would work in that context? But if we think about the spirit of the song, what it means, and it's just like, you know, if it's a fuck you and I'll be me and, you know, I'll do what I want to do, I guess in that sense, it kind of works.
Yeah, I think a lot of because I have actually, funnily enough, played at a pole dancing awards ceremony. And a lot of the tracks are kind of slow, you know, because when they drop down from the top of the pole, it gives that effect because it's slow.
Yeah.
It works. Yeah. So I can see that track working, actually.
I mean, it sounds like for Tori that it was like rejection and adversity that really fueled her in this song, that really fueled her as an artist. Like, even that idea of, you know, they're rejecting the album, but she's like, well, no, like, this is what I'm going to do, and standing by her convictions and that. Very much one of the stories of this album. You know, is that something you can relate to yourself in terms of like adversity driving you to better yourself and to do great things and to kind of build on what you've got?
Yeah, totally. I've always written songs about, you know, people that have annoyed me or so experiences that have frustrated me. So I don't tend to write happy songs. Maybe we'll get there one day.
So we'll move on to Mother. Yeah. So after Winter reflected on Tori's relationship with her father, unsurprisingly, this one touches on her relationship with her mother. I mean, do you think the album benefits from that balance? Because it's kind of a nod to both the parental figures in Tori's life. Do you think, are these kind of companion songs, do you think, or do they feel quite separate?
I think that's lovely, actually. And even though it's called Mother, I've never really twigged it as a nod to a mother. But yeah, I think they're quite separate. I wouldn't place them as, like, you know, coupled as songs about the parents. But yeah.
And I mean, it's interesting because while I think it obviously there is very much an element of that, Tori did talk to Rolling Stone a bit more about some of the deeper meaning of it too. So she said Mother was written to be the polar opposite of Winter. So rather than being coupled, that they are kind of separate. You know, she said, I felt like this mother needed to go beyond the human mother to ideas of creatrix, and that God is not just male, but of the creator being female and male. So again, obviously, we know she's come from a religious background. We've talked about religion being quite a dominant theme on the album. And I guess it's difficult because I know you were saying you're not religious. I'm not massively religious myself. You know, would you say, do you think this, in terms of religion, do you think this is one of the prominent moments on the album, or have you interpreted the song in a different way?
Yeah, to be honest, I never thought of it like that. But I find that fact interesting about God being a man and a woman.
No, I must admit, neither is that. I mean, what does the song mean for you? Because I guess that's the joy of these songs, that, again, they can mean something to her writing them. As we've discussed, they can change in meaning as well. But, you know, to us, they could be something completely different. Like, what does it kind of evoke in you when you hear this song?
I feel like this song has always, you know, made me feel quite calm in a way, which I guess is what your mother should make you feel. Mm-hmm. Quite settled and, you know, calm.
But it's funny, I think about two other songs called Mother. So obviously we've got Pink Floyd's Mother from The Wall. And then I don't know if you've ever heard the song Mother by The Police, which is on Synchronicity, which is just the craziest song you'll ever hear in your entire life. In fact, we covered it on an episode a few years ago, but like, I would recommend anyone to go back and listen to Mother by The Police. And again, they were more about kind of dysfunctional relationships with mothers. Whereas, like you say, this one seems to have a bit more of a calming effect, which is quite nice.
Yeah. I'll have to go listen to that one as well.
Oh, let us know what you think, because it's mental. I've got a quote here again. This is Eric Ross kind of jumping in and kind of saving a song, as it were, again. So she'd said, Mother was written at 6:37 in the morning. We were on a futon in the little place I had at the time in Hollywood. I got up really early and started meandering on the piano. I meandered for about 25 minutes and I started to get this. Obviously, that's at that point in the interview, she's like humming the intro of the song. And I hear this voice from the futon. What's that? And I said, oh, shit, forget about it. And he yells, play it again. So it sounds like, I know he was involved in the production towards the end of the album. It sounds like, as we've said, he was a really positive force in that point in kind of bringing out the best in her.
Yeah, and that's really important. And, you know, I'm glad she had somebody like that by her side. Because it can make or break you, you know, when the person that you love says that they like something, it really does mean the world.
Yeah, definitely. Let's move on to Tear in Your Hand. So Tori opened up to Keyboard magazine that Tear in Your Hand takes a lot of influence from Simon and Garfunkel's Scarborough Fair. She went as far as to call it a blueprint. And I think this is what we've learned as we've gone through, rather than it being comparisons, that it's more like influences and the spirit of stuff coming through.
Yeah.
Do you hear kind of a Simon and Garfunkel vibe in the song? Perhaps Scarborough Fair? Anything like that?
No, I wouldn't have really said that. But again, like, you know, when you say it, you're now thinking, hang on a sec, does it? Because... Mm-hmm. She does do very well at taking influences and changing them, like we've said. But I've put down on this one that it's given me flashbacks when I listened to it last night, you know, to the live gig. I could see the lighting on the stage, and it's been years, like it must have been about 7 years since I've seen her. And it's amazing how stuff like that sticks in your head, because it was quite a special moment. That
I think that's when you know, like, that it's been an experience.
Yeah,
because it's like I've lost count of the amount of gigs I've been to, but there's some where if I hear a certain song or I close my eyes, I'm there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Whereas there's some that I maybe went to a few months ago that I could not remember much of.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, talking about this, because again, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it is. It's more about the way that she takes these influences and makes them her own, rather than it being she's got. Wearing it on a sleeve or across her chest this is Simon and Garfunkel, you know what I mean? She elaborated on this with Keyboard magazine, saying, I remember John Lennon talking about listening to songs that he loved, then changing them to make his own versions. He would say, God, I love this song. I wish I'd written this song. Then it would come out totally different. You might not even know what the song it is that inspired you to do something, but there's that ingredient. Sometimes I do think that we're really just rewriting songs. There are only 12 bloody notes, you know. I can kind of get where she's coming from. And I guess now, 30 years on, you get people like, you know, was it Marvin Gaye's Estate dragged Robin Thicke into court for stealing the essence of a song? Mm. You know what I mean? Like, and all of this kind of stuff, you know. Again, thinking through some of your songs, and I know that you said that, for example, Bad Girl's heavier than the likes of what Tori Amos would do, but do you think that there is kind of the spirit of her music or some of her songs come through into your own stuff?
I think in my earlier, like my first two EPs from my earlier releases, I was kind of playing about with the cheeky songwriting sort of thing. That's what I call it. Like, I'm trying to think of some of the lyrics now, like throw a jellyfish against the wall, stuff like that. It's like, what the heck? But I've been listening to a lot of Meat Puppets at the time as well. So, so I think, yeah, potentially it's quite hard to hear. For me, anyway, I don't know whether anybody else could hear it, but for me, I can't hear her. Maybe some of the little guitar parts, like what we said on Leather, catch little riffs like that, possibly. But yeah.
I mean, so the line, "If you need me, me and Neil will be hanging out with the Dream King," is a reference to author Neil Gaiman and his graphic novel series, The Sandman. So upon release of Little Earthquakes, Neil and Tori struck up a friendship. I think a mutual friend had kind of let him know that she'd kind of name checked him in this song. And to kind of bring things full circle, which I think is really nice, is that so Little Earthquakes, again, 30 years old this year, it's kind of been immortalized, or it's going to be, as a 24-part graphic novel.
Yeah, I was seeing that the other day, actually, and I was thinking, oh, I need to get one of them.
And I think the cool thing about it is, so I think it's all the songs that we're talking about today, and then all kind of the B-sides and other tracks from the sessions, that each part will be a different song. And I think what's really cool about it is that Neil Gaiman, his part is about this song that he's referenced in. So I think it's a really nice way to kind of bring it all back together. So it's not out till September, but I might have to get it myself, actually, because it seems like a really cool, really cool idea, a really cool way to celebrate 30 years of this album as well.
Yeah, I think any mega Tori Amos fan needs that.
So we've referenced this song a couple of times already. So we've got Me and a Gun.
Yeah.
So a bit of a showstopper of a song next. Very powerful, very hard hitting. As we've said, it's just Tori a cappella, no instrumental accompaniment. And she's always been very open. And I think I'll say from the offset, I wouldn't usually do this, but again, obviously this song does deal with some very like sensitive subjects. So if it's something that might like upset people, you know, feel free to kind of skip forward a bit. But she's always been very open that the song is about the fact that she was raped at knife point at the age of 21. And she's just substituted a knife for a gun in the lyrics. But that's what it's about. I mean, really difficult, horrible experience that I couldn't even comprehend. What do you make of the song and the bravery that it's taken for her to kind of tell this story on the album?
It's just unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, especially as you know, a young woman myself who could be in that position out in LA. It's kind of, it hits home, I guess. And you know, it makes you stop and think, does this track, and just, you know, wow, what she's been through. And, you know, and for her to document it, because not many people would want to talk about it, and she's written it, and then she's recorded it, and, you know, she's a very strong lady for sure. I don't know whether she plays it live at all.
I know she definitely did at a time. Yeah. She might have kind of put it to bed now, but I guess you're right, because there's the experience, there's the writing of it, the recording of it, and then inevitably performing it live, she did at some point.
Yeah.
People asking questions about it. You know, for me, obviously, we're going to talk about it kind of out of respect for her. I don't really want to go into the details of it any more than I have to. Because, you know, it's so to think, you know, all of that experience, it kind of prolongs that for her. But at the same time, hopefully it was quite a cathartic experience for her. Hopefully it's something that kind of set her free a little bit to be able to tell a story.
Yeah, I think everybody deals with things in their own way, and if that's how she wanted to deal with it, then, you know, yeah, it's absolutely fine. And, you know, I think it's made other people stop and think, and maybe, you know, it's a very difficult one to talk about, isn't it? But I think one of the lyrics in that, and you know, there's a lot of things going around at the minute in the music scene for women, like, you know, certain attention we might attract when we wear certain things on stage. And I think one of the lyrics that she said, like, slanky red thing, does that mean that should happen to me? Or, you know, basically what she was saying. And it's close to the burn, basically, for a lot of people, that, because, you know, we all put ourselves up there in the spotlight, but it doesn't mean that, you know, that's acceptable.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think the decision, and there's something you picked up on, like, way earlier in our chat, but obviously there's this decision to make it a cappella. So,
yeah,
You know, there's no music on this track at all. I'd have to be fair, like, I'd have to go back and check. I think this is probably the first song we've done on the podcast where it's literally just someone's voice. You know what I mean? No musical accompaniment. Only she could truly say why she chose to do that. But I do think that that's something that, you know, makes it even more powerful, because you're just listening to her voice and her story. Do you think that would have been diminished or kind of diluted had it been kind of her and the piano, or if she'd gone for kind of a full band on the track?
Yeah, totally. I think it would have lost all meaning. I mean, you can hear every breath, every little sort of moment of hesitation that she's, you know, feeling still, that pain of, you know, what she's been through. Yeah, it's, she did the totally right thing there by not having any music on it, definitely.
I mean, she did speak about it in a TV interview. I think this was earlier on in her career. She said it had always been a cappella. And when I started writing it, I knew exactly what I wanted to say. I was almost in a trance writing that song. I was back there in that experience, and yet another part of me was guiding it on. I felt like I was protected writing it. When it was over, when I had looked at what I had written, and the hardest part is performing it every night, because yeah, although I know I'm safe, a part of me has to go to that place to sing it. And I guess, like I say, I genuinely, I've not been lucky enough to see her in concert, so I don't know if this is a song that she sings anymore, but I certainly couldn't blame her if it is one that she's retired and thought, you know what, like, I've given this to the world, but now I'm done with it, essentially.
Yeah, totally. I can't honestly remember if she did play it. I doubt it, because especially it's been so long ago now, you know, it's maybe time for her to put it to bed. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, NME, Call Me in a Gun, Little Earthquake's most stunning moment, a revelatory song of unflinching honesty, singing a cappella about a rape she suffered, we're driven to exactly that place, time and feeling. The stream of consciousness intensity she summons during this song almost feels like a piece of guerrilla theatre. But perhaps that is because it's so shockingly real. For anyone who hasn't heard the album, I've got a feeling when we announce this one, I think a lot of people will have heard it. But
yeah,
I think if you haven't, this is one of the most powerful songs you'll ever hear. And probably one of the most difficult we've had to talk about on the podcast, but an important song to talk about, I think.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
I mean, we've talked about, obviously, you talked about Leather being your favourite song. You know, I've said, you know, for me and many people, it's Winter. You know, how integral would you say? Because I get the sense, with all the respect in the world, I don't imagine for many people this is their favourite song in kind of putting it in that context. But how important and integral do you think Me and a Gun is to kind of the experience of listening to this album?
I've actually got written down on my notes here that I don't like to listen to it. I do. I know we said no skippers, but it is quite painful to listen to, because you know what it's about. And I think it's important that she put it on there because it allowed the world to see her.
Yeah,
you know, if you're putting yourself out there for the first time, that is part of your story, so you can't miss such an important, you know, part of what made her so strong, I guess. And yeah, you know, that awful experience, and I think it's really important that it's on there. Yeah,
and I think if it even kind of gave just one person the courage to kind of speak
exactly
out
that,
or to
yeah, exactly,
to report an experience, then it was more than worthwhile, wasn't it?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to the final track on the album, which is our title track, Little Earthquakes. Merry-Go-Round magazine call it a shifting, slow-burning song that renders personal turmoil on the grandest possible scale, using images of birds being shot from the sky, vampires dancing in graveyards, immolation and disintegration. Amos mediates on the fragility of interpersonal relationships and the nature of hatred, a cleansing and forceful final word that helps to contextualize the remainder of the record. So I always think it's interesting what, because sometimes people will just pick a title, a song as the title track because it's a cool name, you know. Sometimes it's because it encapsulates everything that the album's about. What do you think it is in this case? Do you think it is? Do you think Little Earthquakes does kind of sum up everything that's come before, or do you think it's just a cool name for an album?
I think it does sum the album up, because all these experiences have been little earthquakes, probably, for her. That's how I would see it. You know, all these little bumps and shakes. You know, as she says in this song, from memory, she says, "Here we go again."
Mm-hmm.
I love that, because it's like, oh God, another earthquake. You know what I mean? So, but also, it's a wicked title, isn't it? At the end of the day, I think it's quite well chosen. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she talked a lot to Rolling Stone about kind of where she was when she was writing it, talking about miscommunication with friends and family, that sort of thing. And she says that in that moment, she says, I needed to pull back and relook at my life and who was in my life and the kinds of people I wanted in my life, the kind of person I could be in a relationship with where I wasn't able to maybe be what someone needed me to be.
Yeah.
So I needed to be with somebody else who could give me what they needed. This was a real turning point in claiming what kind of life I wanted to live. It was a real beginning. So I think you've probably hit the nail right on the head that this does sum up the album in many ways, because it's almost not, and I'd read a review saying that it's maybe not necessarily in chronological order, but the album is like a chronicle of her trying to find herself across these 12 songs.
Yeah, you can hear that, definitely.
I mean, how does it end the album for you, this track? So as we get to the end of Little Earthquakes, kind of, what are you left with? Kind of how are you feeling when we get to the end?
Well, I always think, oh, that was good. I always listen to it in full, this album. It's a definite just like, right, I'm putting that on and listen to everything. And I don't do that with any album, I don't think. Yeah, it's a special one for me. This track has, as all of them do, it has feeling, but the chords are definitely feel special to me. And it's like, it is like a all-rounder, like, right, this is done now. And, you know, the end, basically. But not a blunt full stop. It's like, right, that was cool.
I mean, it's like a truly important album for so many reasons. And I guess the word I've got here is authentic. Like, it's one of the most authentic, honest albums I've ever heard. I think most classic albums, they leave their mark on the music that follows. I'd argue that kind of Little Earthquakes, particularly with songs like Me and a Gun, for example, cause a bigger cultural shift than perhaps we could possibly know. I genuinely believe that. I'll leave the last word with Slant, who said the following about the legacy the Little Earthquakes leaves in its wake. So they say, fostering such an inextricable bond with her audience and so early in her career resulted in a rare mutual trust that allowed the artist to take her music into strange and commercially perilous places. Like the Sojourn to Hell and Back, that is her 1996 breakup album, Boys for Pele, and 2011's classical-inspired song cycle, Night of Hunters. Even if Amos hadn't continually pushed the limits of her signature instrument in mainstream music itself over the course of the following decade, Little Earthquakes would still stand alongside Nevermind as an album that reshaped the pop rock landscape. 30 years later, the reverberations are still being felt. I mean, with that in mind, that's kind of their summary of it. I mean, why do you think and why do you believe Little Earthquakes has stood the test of time?
Because it is different, it's unique, and it's just quality songwriting, let's be honest. I mean, there has been nobody else that I know of. I know we've mentioned people like Agnes Obel, but there's been nobody else that has written that amount of material, you know, within such a short space of time, let's be honest, and been able to do it well. Because, I mean, how do you even begin to top that album? But she has done, and she's, you know, full credit to her there.
And I mean, finally, why is Little Earthquakes your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
There's very few albums that I'll put on and listen all the way through. Like this one, you can't just, it's like a book that you can't put down, basically. That's how I describe it. And if you haven't listened to it and you are into that sort of heavier music, maybe just give it a shot, because sometimes it's nice to listen to different stuff. And also just, yeah, any musician that hasn't listened to it, please do, because it will hit you, I guess, in a way. I can't describe it. It's such a powerful album that I can't even begin to, you know, it's hard, isn't it? We started off this interview saying, like, I hope we do it justice, but it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Well, Loss, thank you very much for joining me. It's been awesome, and I'm really pleased you picked it. Like, I'm really pleased that we've been able to do Little Earthquakes on the show. I know we've talked about Bad Girl. That came out in February, didn't it? And I know that you've got a tour coming up with Firekind in the summer.
Yep.
Is there anything else that we can expect from you kind of over the next few months?
Yeah, so on the 10th of April, we hit the road and we play in Camden. And then we come back up and play York and Manchester. And basically, we're on the road as soon as April 10th hits. We are constantly on the road. So just check the website out, basically, for gig tickets and stuff. So it's www.loscampbellmusic.co.uk.
Thank you so much to Loz for taking that time out and joining me. to chat all about this awesome album, Little Earthquakes. And it's great, you know, when the guests can come on and share their love of the album, but then come away with something as well. Like, I think Loz really enjoyed hearing a lot of the stories of this album and just kind of learning a bit about Tori and all that sort of stuff. And that's what this podcast is all about, that deep love for these classic albums, but also kind of discovering and getting excited about new artists as well. And both of our episodes in May have had some fantastic guests in Loz Campbell and Dan Morris from Firekind. Firekind and Loz are touring together throughout July across the UK. It's going to be an awesome tour. I know it's one that, you know, a lot of people are really excited about. Two really fantastic up-and-coming artists on the UK rock scene touring together. You know, what could be better than that? July 3rd, they'll be in Nice and Sleazy at Glasgow. July 4th, they'll be at Trillions in Newcastle, hoping to get to that one myself. July the 5th, the Jacaranda in Liverpool. July the 6th, Victoria Vaults in York. July the 7th, the County Music Bar in Chesterfield, and then they're wrapping up the tour at the Asylum 2 on July the 8th in Birmingham. Get yourself the sea tickets, or of course, check out firekind.com or lozcampbellmusic.co.uk to find out where you can get tickets, how you can make sure that you get to the shows. As I've said, I'm going to try and get the Trillions. If you do see me, feel free to come and say hello. It'll be nice to kind of catch up with Loz and Firekind and kind of see them both perform. I think it's going to be a really awesome tour and not one to be missed. Also not to be missed, our next episode in just a couple of weeks' time. You know, a few months ago, we looked back at Neil Young's After the Gold Rush album with Jack J. Hutchinson. So we did talk a little bit about this album, Deja Vu, by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young at the time. And I was thinking to myself, like, I hope we do that soon. Like, I'm just in the mood to do it now. And then along comes Aaron Day from These Wicked Rivers, answers my prayers and says that he'd like to do Deja Vu. So perfect. That'll be on the 1st of June. And then on the 15th, as I've said, we'll be celebrating the awesomeness that is Hybrid Theory by Linkin Park. So fantastic albums for June. Really looking forward to you checking those out. Thank you for joining me today. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.